Hello again, and welcome back to the Gaming News Canada show. And yes, I'm still your host, Steve McAllister. It's been a few months since we last spoke with Paul Burns, but that's okay. He's a busy man in his role as president and CEO of the Canadian Gaming Association, and also as the head coach of the Leaside U18BB Wildcats. With the Wildcats season ending last weekend at the Ontario Women's Hockey Association Provincial Championships, we felt the timing was right to invite Paul back to the podcast. Paul, thank you as always for being here.
Thank you, Steve. Great to be here. I appreciate you inviting me back.
Hey, Paul, listen, just before we get into the dig into the world that you spend your 9 to 5 hours in, I do want to congratulate you on your long run coaching in the Leaside Wildcats girls program. And I think the last time we had a chat about hockey, and I think every time we run into each other, we do spend at least a few minutes talking about hockey. You indicated to me that this is going to be your farewell season. Your daughter's graduating from minor hockey this year, and so just want to see if that's still the case, that this was your swan song. And I think you and I, we traded emails on the weekend, and having gone through the same thing a couple of years ago myself, kind of walking away from girls hockey, it's pretty emotional that final weekend when you do realize not just the season's over, but a big chapter of your life.
It is, and it was a bit of an emotional weekend. I mean, my daughter's heading off to the University of Alberta next year and moving on with her life, but we've been since she was 8 years old. And been a part of spending in the winter months many hours a week on the ice and going to rinks, and because of the nature of girls hockey, we travel around the province. So a lot of car time together, which has been awesome. And that's the benefits of watching and being close with your daughter. To be able to do that has been amazing. But also we had 9 girls as part of our team who've been together. I think the least amount was about 4 years, and some was upward of 6. Watching these ladies grow up, it's always funny. I mentioned the beginning of this year, no one was driving themselves to practice. By the end, half the team drives themselves to practice. Those little time moment things you recognize that they're growing up, and remarkable young women. And I said to them, you came of age in women's hockey at a time when women's hockey became something. And I said, that's something to remark that you were part of that and watched it. I've had the benefit of, and I said, the big difference was, is like I had ability, like Jenna Hefford ran practices for my team over the years. Corey Chevrier, who was, assistant coach for Team Canada and the World Championship win on the weekend, but also now the Ottawa or Montreal PWHL team. She was a skills instructor for 3 seasons. My last skills instructor is Kerry Whelan, who was a member of Team USA in the 2010 Olympics and was the first year women's hockey was the NCAA. She was part of the Wisconsin team that won. And all these, having access to these kinds of role models for women in hockey have been tremendous. And the fact that where we've gotten to now and over the years of going back through retro with the pictures and stuff, when we put the Clarkson Cup and its first time as a team, and we're now, been part of watching this PW come together, it's remarkable. And it's sort of saying that to ladies, one, you can keep playing. That women's, there's leagues and university leagues, intramurals, places for women to keep playing hockey. And in fact, they're growing senior leagues in the GTA, which is another thing that we're liking to see and hoping to do more of, is when they finish playing hockey, or going to university, and if they come back to the GTA, they can continue to play competitive hockey if they want to. And those are good things that we're seeing from this. And being able to be a part of that has been amazing. It was an emotional weekend, but we've an amazing parent group, and amazing group of young ladies who love hockey and played hard till the end. So it was a great season for that. Now I have 20 extra hours in a week or so that I will have to figure out how to fill next winter.
As I tell people often, Paul, it's fantastic that people like you and I as fathers get to be on the bench with our children. And I was fortunate enough to coach my two daughters in the Brampton Canadettes Association. And to your point mm-hmm. earlier, I think the thing I miss most about that time together are the car rides and, you know, just spending time with your daughters that we don't really get to do, especially as they become teenagers and young women. And you know, I really hope the day isn't too far away when girls and women's hockey don't need old guys like you and I behind the bench anymore, because we have this generation of young women like your daughter and my two daughters who are coaching. And we saw on the weekend a young woman, Laura Katakis, who's a graduate of the Brampton Canadettes and the Etobicoke Dolphins girls hockey programs, working as a linesman working the lines in the bronze medal game of the World Women's Hockey Championship. So yeah, it feels like you and I have had, you know, very small roles, but have been fortunate to participate in girls and women's hockey at a time of incredible growth, and to see what's going on with the Professional Women's Hockey League. It just kind of, that's a culmination of all those efforts.
It is. And it's also to show there's still a lot of work to be done. As you both and I know, and it comes to women joined our coaching staff this year as much as she could. Natasha was a player with the U of T Blues, which went to the national championships, and she, in her fifth year, she's going on to law school next year. Her playing career came to an end a month or so ago with the national championships when the U of T won the silver. But it is... finding those voices, so people, the women, like, that want to lend their time to being on the bench and making space, because we did. And that's why my skills instructors were mostly all women over the years. The voices that you have and the other voices, and we can do our bit as guys, and we need to do a lot of work in the refereeing side to encourage more women to be referees. The lack of referees that look like me, which shouldn't be the case. You know, old white guys, no. Guys that can keep up with the play, women can keep up with the play, that's what we need. Yeah, and that's why there's still lots of work to do with more female coaches and encouraging that. And I think it's coming. I think we've seen, that's why I said to the ladies of my team who are graduating on, there's more infrastructure now for you, there's more room for you than there was before. And that's the one thing we've benefited from this, and we got to keep working on it. Because that's going to be really important, because the job ain't done and there's lots of work to do.
Yeah, it's a passionate topic for both of us. I think one day we'll do a podcast and we'll dedicate an entire podcast to talking about the state of girls and women's hockey in Ontario one day, because I know it's something that you and I love to talk about. Hey, let's get back to where the reason why we wanted to get you on today. And we're recording this interview on Tuesday, April 16th, 12 days after the two-year anniversary of regulated sports betting and iGaming in Ontario. And you and I didn't have a chance to talk back on April 4th, but I'd like to start by just asking you for some thoughts on 2 years later and where this industry is right now and where it's come from, or where it's come in a little over 24 months.
Yeah, it still is one to look back on, as we did even a year ago, the remarkable nature of what's occurred. The CGA, is we'll have to talk about, we promote regulated gaming. That's what we want to see across the country. That's what we want to see, because with regulated gaming comes greater consumer protection, great opportunity for economic benefits, all of those things we've talked about. But watching what has occurred in Ontario by simply creating a regime and inviting whoever wanted to come, and what has shown up on the door. And it's a wide mix of companies. Obviously, some of the largest operators in the world are here. And but there's homegrown operators in the marketplaces. The rivalries, which started here and are conquering the rest of the world, to North Star Bets, to a startup like Betty, which is, you know, a site that's concentrating on marketing female slot players. And there's room for everybody. And that's something that we as the association and one of advocating for industry is ensuring that we, the market can sustain those kinds of opportunities for companies to come. And I think there's more we can do there, but I think in the, what's been created to start has been very good. And I only do it because there's a lot of people who did a lot of great work in a lot of very short period of time to make this happen. And the ADCO and IGO and the government of Ontario and Doug Downey in particular, who's been a tremendous champion, that we also can't take it for granted. And we got to keep our hands on making sure that it's an attractive market and making sure that it's it works for as many operators as we can. Not everybody. Let the competition decide who gets to stay and go, and not rules or policies or any other red tape or regulation that may get in the way. And that's what we want to make sure that it's still done. Because what we're seeing is we've got a marketplace with some of the highest levels of player protection in the world. We have ability for, we've created jobs and economic benefits for the province of Ontario. So there's on a lot of cases, and I've listened to, the Deputy Attorney General and Martha Otten hosted a reception in, around the 4th to recognize, mark the day on the second anniversary. But the government objectives around this, about creating greater consumer protection, providing some revenue to stay and economic opportunity for the province, that they have checked the boxes in terms of policy objectives achieved. And I think that's something that's important to recognize, that there was, it wasn't led with how much money can we make. It wasn't met with, it was met with understanding we want to create greater consumer choice, which they've done, greater consumer protection, which they've done, creating economic benefits, which they've done. Those are the things that, that were important to them, and it wasn't, and it's worked. And I think that's what's to be celebrated. And that's why I'm, you know, we're thrilled the way things have gone. And, but we also caution and say, you can't take things for granted. And we have to keep to making sure that it's a market that works for as many as possible. Not to lower your standards or change your standards, but to make sure that, that there's room for places that where, you know, it's regulation that's appropriate and more necessary and that's effective. And policies and reporting and rules that are effective, that meet the needs, but not to be not to be overburdened either. To be to do what's necessary, but also understand that you know, we want to create a marketplace where people can come in and compete and to offer their services and business. So I think we've done a great job, and I think it's terrific to celebrate.
Over the 3+ years we've been covering the industry, and really the last 2 years of what's going on in Ontario, there we've talked often about, you know, when's consolidation happening, and when would the market shrink here? And as you know, we do this interview on in the afternoon, about 3 or 4 hours after iGaming Ontario posted that Casino Time is just launched in Ontario. That's the 49th operator in the province now. And although we've seen a few operators left, Unibet left in March, and we've seen a couple of others, that consolidation and that shrinking hasn't really happened. I mean, what do you attribute that to, Paul?
Well, I think it's still for people, it's testing the market. I think the next, you know, the period of time people made investments, they want to see if those investments can return profit to them and revenue. The bar for entry wasn't financially exceptionally high for Ontario, right? You have to meet the regulatory requirements and suitability for registration of the ADCO and enter into the agreement with IGO and meet all of the reporting standards and other measures. And so it wasn't, because what we've seen in U.S. markets, for example, the market access agreements and limited access to markets for companies, the lack of a full suite of iCasino products has created a different marketplace down there, which I say to people, don't compare. It's not apples to apples. It's closer to maybe Michigan, potentially, as a jurisdiction which we can look to and others. But a lot of cases that limiting access and others has not been done. You know, that's been the hallmark. And then you've created dominant players in the marketplace and not enough oxygen for smaller ones. And that's what we've seen here is I think the companies that have left for company reasons, not necessarily for market reasons. And I think that that's something to be important with. Is consolidation going to happen? Yes, it is. There was a frothiness in 2020-21 in the United States that has led some companies to make investments and do things they thought would pan out a certain way. They haven't. Is some of that going to spill into Ontario? Potentially could. I think that, Unibet entered Ontario with customers in a market. They went into the United States with none. And I think that part of leaving, because companies talk about leaving North America, it's the United States and Canada and Ontario particularly make it dragged along, not for because it's particularly been a problem. It's just that for some, it may not justify even staying on the continent. And so I get that. And that's the same. But I think what we can look to is that's been part of where we'll see consolidation coming. The industry goes through phases. Of this, and from a games on the slot side, Everi and IGT coming together, merging the Everi's exceptional fintech and slot products with IGT's depth and reach in the slot market. Those things happen, and it's the nature of now who owns these companies in a lot of ways, and how they've grown up is under one set of ownership. IGT was a widely held company at one point, and now it's been basically the purview of the Lottomatica family and others. So you get the ownership dictates some of this stuff, where it'll go, and people wanting return on investments that maybe not be met by staying the status quo. Those decisions are going to be made. I read an article today about all of the boards and companies that are doing evaluations and hiring consultants. And it comes to that. And that's a cycle the industry will go through. And we will have a round of some level of consolidation or exits of markets. But it's for business reasons. A lot of cases, it's not Ontario's market particularly. And that's fine. And that happens. And that's sort of the cycle of life, shall we say, and the way things work with companies. So it's, it's a chance that and we've seen some acquisitions outside of the gaming directly. Like you look at the Better Collective acquisition of Playmaker. Playmaker built a tremendous business in the Americas, like a phenomenal set, and they will set the bar for Better Collective going forward. I mean, I'm a big fan of what they did in that space, but there's an example of not just the gaming side, but the sports media, the parlay and Hometown, your company and what you guys have been able to do in this marketplace. And there's room for innovators still. And that's the encouraging part, like from product and services to the industry that we've seen, and Thomas and Curacao Sports and some others that have come out of and are still coming out, the guys at Low Six, creating products and doing work and creating. That's the exciting part of what is another facet to this, and what has been created by creating this marketplace is allowing innovators and risk takers to come and be successful and find opportunity.
Yeah, we can add quarter four too. The company co-founded by Kelly Brooks and Daniela Kovich that was sold to Fairplay Sports back in January. And ironically, as we do this interview today, Fairplay has announced that Kelly's going to be the new chief product officer for Fairplay. And again, have a soft spot in my heart for the work that Daniela and Kelly had done to build quarter four.
Exactly. And that's the phenomenal part of and they started long before the market started in Ontario, but they were able to benefit from it. And that's the same with the Rivalry did and others have, the fact that trying to explain to policymakers that, creating that regulated marketplace was the last piece of the puzzle. Because Canada has punched way above its weight in the iGaming space since its inception over 20 years ago, when you go back to PokerStars being founded in Richmond Hill, but there's Scheinbergs and the Rifkin family with CryptoLogic, which was at the forefront of iGaming in the late 90s. And the people that I always say you could kid, you create an ancestry.com, everybody that works for Cryptologic that's now found their way through the industry. But that's an amazing sort of where, but reason those companies left was because there was no way to get licensed. There was no regulatory regime. There was no, so they went to where those jurisdictions were. In a lot of cases, that was Europe. And so that's the benefit we've seen, even the small, the few companies we've talked about, there'll be more. And that's great. And that's something that, that we understand when you're building an industry is what we're doing. And you know, the Deloitte report that I go contracted was, gave us a snapshot of what that first year looked like. But there's, when you, you know, I think that, like, you know, the Levy family was, I think it was, there was, I think John celebrated the fact that, that going back and telling ESPN how to get in the betting business was kind of a nice turnaround for him. And the fact that over many years, there was a lot of people that were not on his side in what he believed in. So I think that there's, you know, there's countless success stories and more to come. And I think that's the more to come is the real important part to remember. And why we have to be diligent about making sure our market works.
You mentioned Canada punching above its weight, and we had Brianne Dora-Schwal on the podcast on the previous episode talking about responsible gambling and problem gambling. And you know, Brianne's been fairly critical of some of the stuff that she's seeing in the U.S. and other parts in the world, but she was quite complimentary about the work that's been done in Ontario and Canada, and mentioned the Responsible Gambling Council and BCLC with its Game Sense program, and OLG too with this product as well. And the country has a pretty good history when it comes to responsible gambling, problem gambling. Doesn't mean it can't be better. I know we've talked on the previous iterations of the Gaming News Canada show, Paul, about iGaming Ontario's efforts to have a centralized self-exclusion program, and is still trying to put the foundation in place to do that. But for the most part, Ontario and other provinces across the country have done a pretty good job in that area.
We have, and this is why I'm when we get into people talking about what's happened in other jurisdictions, just because the UK had sports betting, what happened over there is going to happen here because we have sports betting. It's nonsense. The fact, the commitment for, you know, on the principle of informed choice is what a lot of this is built on, educating players on how to play responsibly, how to use the product in a responsible manner. Warning of its dangers, which we've done as an industry from its inception in the night, like back in the 90s. That's when part of this, like when the gaming industry in Canada started to expand in the early 90s to mid 90s, responsible gaming was always part of the discussion. It's how to, you know, whether it's educating 1-800 numbers, it's evolved, and we've continued to evolve as we've learned as an industry, and it's, and player tools in the online space, and understanding, training staff in every casino, staff in the country gets trained to understand responsible gaming, spotting problem gambling, and how to do interventions with players and helping people seek help and finding those pathways to treatment. This has been part of the conversation since our gaming's inception. It's part of the DNA of the industry in Canada. And that's something that you can't say in a lot of other places. Like for a lot of years, there was more research dollars available in Canada than was in the United States. That we created more research, and we created organizations like Responsible Gambling Council, who whose mission was to work and to build, you know, through education and awareness and research, build a capacity in this country, and working with the lottery corporations who embrace it because of the government involvement. Some people are critical of it sometimes. Sometimes it frustrates me, no question. I'll be honest about that. But at the same time, it's had the benefits of what we've seen. And that's where, when the AGCO started to look at the regulatory standards for iGaming, it went to looking at best practices in the world. Because some of the tools, some of the things like monitoring players for risk, has been done in other jurisdictions. The technology didn't really exist in a usable format 5 years ago, but it does today. And so let's incorporate it. Like, there was no fear in wanting to say, we're going to do this. It was, we should do it. And there, you know, the question of bonusing incentives, because, you know, I had had conversations with my counterparts at the AGA and saying, like, this isn't giving away thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to players. Is one, is it sustainable? Two, is it the healthiest way to start a relationship with a customer? And the question, and there's a lot of people still having those conversations in the United States where it's still prevalent. But, you know, a couple of years back when, you know, Arizona was opening and there was like $11,000 in free play available to any people who want to sign up. Or when you look at the first months of Ohio, and the fact that there was huge handle numbers, but no one made any money because they were playing with the house money. And it's like, hang on a second. Now, are these the best ways to start these relationships? And I think that's the question we've all had. And I think in the AGCO rightfully said, no, we don't want to do that. And, you know, there was no incentives whatsoever in the first draft of the regulatory standards, but we've been showing what can be done in terms of making sure that people aren't, we're not pushing it on them, but they're coming to find it and they can offer it as a customer, and making, you know, people have to opt in to receive bonuses, incentives from operators. Those little things make a big difference. And I think that it shows, you know, the industry's commitment to having, you know, healthy relationships with customers, making sure that people use the product in a manner that's, you know, suits their, what they can afford, and the fact that it's entertainment, and all of those measures and all of those efforts are, they're built into the ingrained in most of the companies that are operating, because that's what they want. That's what they understand, that they, you know, no one from this industry denies the fact that we know people have control issues with our products. Like, that's not, you don't need to stay, no one needs to ask that or state it again. That's what we, everybody works from every day, and understanding that we want healthy relationships with customers. And so, yeah, it's the attributes here have sort of said, I think we'll start to, the benefits of regulated gaming. That's what comes, because we still have swaths of this country that are playing in the gray markets and without those controls. And, you know, even a few weeks ago, we saw that the RCMP, you know, and the OPP and others broke up a betting ring. They were running, organized crime is running two online sites. And it's like, that's what's in the unregulated space. And so we need to encourage governments to regulate all gaming in their jurisdictions. And that's something we still, we promote and we want to encourage, because with that, you get the two things in Ontario led with: greater consumer protection, greater economic benefits.
A word from our sponsor.
Hey there, sports fans. Are you looking for fresh and fun takes on the hottest topics in Canadian sports? Well, we've got just what you need. Introducing Homestand Sports Today, your go-to daily sports newsletter, bringing you the Canadian angle on the hottest NHL, NBA, footy stories, and more right to your inbox. But wait, there's more. Homestand Sports isn't just another text-heavy newsletter. Every story has its own video featuring our talented hosts like me, Albert Vartanian, giving you a newsletter experience like never before. And did I mention it's a free subscription? Subscribe now at homestand.ca.
Now back to the show.
The CGA announced, Paul, I believe back in December, that you were creating a working group to put together an action plan on responsible gambling. Can you maybe just talk a little bit about what the mandate of that working group is and what the status is of that action plan?
Yeah, it's we had an event in early December. We had almost 100 people in a room to talk about a workshop on creating guiding principles for the CGA as RG guiding principles on responsible gaming. It was a great workshop. The working group has heard back from Tracy Parker from RGC, did an amazing job at running that workshop for us that day. And it was a diverse group from representing operators from land-based and online, suppliers, and non-members, so people even from the treatment side and beyond, direct operations in gaming were there, and it was a great day, and we had great dialogue and feedback. So the committee has taken some of that work now. We've taken that work, gone back and worked with Tracy and Team TRGC, and we'll soon go back and report back on where we are. That's going to come very soon. So that was really the first step for us. That same day, we announced that we are working with Ad Standards Canada to develop a national advertising code for gaming. That code is still being drafted, and it will soon go out to consult with industry stakeholders as a way of demonstrating the industry's commitment in terms of our advertising standards. A lot of it, you know, we have lots of rules around advertising. Everybody thinks, oh, there's no rules around. There's lots. Between Think TV, the regulatory standards of regulators across the country, gaming advertising is well regulated, and there's lots of oversight over it. And so we're going to just try to codify some of that. And also, it's a guide for operators in the marketplace, because the other thing that's changed is it's not just governments and government crown agencies running operating gaming anymore. There's private sector companies delivering casinos. There's private sector companies in the online space. And so it's a way for everybody to have tools to make sure that they're staying within the guidelines and standards. And the biggest thing of what we're trying to do with our RG working group, and what's going to evolve as it continues and it will expand its membership and grow into more things. But one of the things we've really talked about from the beginning was telling the industry stories about the commitment to responsible gaming, the work that's done every day by gaming operators and online companies and casinos and others, the research that's done in the market. We want to tell those stories a part of this too, because the industry, I don't think, gets enough credit for the work it's been doing. And the fact that we know that problem gambling rates have been fairly consistent for a long, long time. But the point being is that we know people still have control issues. We have evolved because of technology and tools allow us to do different and new things, like monitoring players' play for risk, more known play. To try and encourage more known play from players. So we understand players' behavior and what they're doing, and being able to help and using, like, people have said, we can actually protect players in circumstances now because of the technology. So all of that embracing is telling the stories. And that's something we want to do. We're not going to change any way people approach this. If we can encourage people to do better in their own company programs and they do things, we'll do that. But we also want to tell the stories, because there's remarkable work being done from the research community in Canada. We have done a great deal of work above and beyond. And that's why I tend to get a bit more animated when people say, well, you know, you should be doing this because the UK is doing that. And I'm like, no, we've had the discussions they're having, we had 10 years ago or more. They're just starting to fund organizations now. We've been doing it for 20 years. So I think that there's parts where we got to celebrate what we've done, but also get our, you know, be proud of what the work we're doing and the work we continue to do. And that's really what we want to do through this exercise. Because there are new people in the marketplace, and understanding that this is what, there's an expectation as well as an operator, if you're coming new to the marketplace, of what the RG standards are, what you're prepared to do, what you need to be doing as an operator. Because as I said, it's never about lowering standards. It's about making sure everybody can rise to meet them.
Yeah. And I know, you know how I feel about this, Paul. I think you've been kind of alone on an island too often in telling that story. You do a great job of telling the story, but it seems every time there's a contentious issue, whether it's a CBC show or a Globe and Mail article or a radio program, it's Paul Burns who's the front person for the industry. And I think, to me, it doesn't make sense, because you and I both go to these conferences, and doing this for 3 years now, I've met a lot of smart people who work in this industry. And I agree with you. I think there are some really good stories to tell, but trying to get, whether it's the AGCO or iGaming Ontario or or operators to step up and tell those stories. I think that's been a struggle. And again, I think that conversation needs to go beyond the conferences where everybody, that's a friendly forum, and the industry as a whole does need to do a better job getting out and telling those stories that you mentioned.
They do. I mean, you know, it's the fact is, be proud of what we've done. And I am. Governments have always had an uneasy relationship with gaming. I've had the pleasure of being around. I started in this business, a political staffer in a government that worked to expand gaming. But there was a push and pull inside of government to understand. And it's always been a challenge. And the reality is, I look at it today, is that this industry has existed as a highly regulated, legal entertainment product available for people of Canada. And it's been that way for 30 plus years now. Gaming is a product that's accepted. It's available. Generations now have grown up with it, because we do have some generations that didn't grow up with it and have some pretty strong opinions about that in terms of what it was perceived to be. And then there's a lot of that conversation goes about, oh, well, we're normalizing. Yeah, we are. It is. Like, let's be honest about this. It exists. The internet was a great disruptor for many sectors. It disrupted our industry. It had disrupted the model of gaming in Ontario and Canada. Ontario chose to do something about it. Because, you know, that you can't have monopolies anymore. It doesn't exist. The government of Canada decided not to regulate the internet until recently. Well, the reality is that then it disrupted a lot of businesses. And you've got industry after industry that you can point to that has been disrupted by the internet. And there's lots of them. And you got to change. And you have to create rules and regulations that fit that. And I'm sorry, it's uncomfortable for some people, but the reality is that's what's happened. And so meet the challenge, take care of your responsibilities, and do that. And that's what we have encouraged governments to do, because you need, if you do that, and then you can start to understand that this is, it's a product that it's not for everybody. Roughly 20% of the population doesn't like gaming, never will. We've done enough polling over the years to understand that there's, from moral objections to other strongly held beliefs in other ways, that we don't participate in that. Okay, that's fine. And there's lots of probably other products and services and things that people don't. The rates of problem gambling have been fairly consistent between 0.5%, 1.5% of the population has serious problems with gambling. Others have control issues in some of that. Problem gambling doesn't exist by itself. It's a comorbidity with other mental health issues. And that's, those are the kinds of, in that perspective, and we understand all of these things, and that, you know, alcoholism is probably 5 times greater problem in society than problem gambling. But there's a newness to some of the stuff that keeps bringing these conversations back again. And that's where we have to continue to have the conversations about educating people on what we are and what we're not. And that's why it's online gaming in Ontario, having created a regulated marketplace, brought the conversations back. It's, oh, like, I shouldn't be seeing these ads. Well, did you notice you were seeing those ads recently, but from, like, offshore companies the size that play for free? Or did you know that Canadians were spending billions of dollars every year through offshore unregulated sites? No. But when you want to, now we want to put a basket around it. I had a discussion recently with somebody talking about, well, there's over 800 sites targeting British Columbia. And I'm like, yeah, okay. There's about over 2,000 gaming sites, online gaming sites in the world. Okay, so there's 800. That's fine. I said, well, Ontario did is actually try to limit. And they've gone down to like 77 that they'd really like people to deal with. Well, we found from recent IGO research, there's maybe there's 350 that are accessing. Well, that's smaller than 800. And we got work to do still. But the point being is, with regulation, you provide opportunity and you promote it. And that's the key. And that's one of the advice I have, if I hear anything, for the province of Alberta. Go out and tell people what you're trying to do before you start. And that's really the key, is that understand that there's hundreds of millions of dollars every month leaving the country, going to offshore online sites, because that's what Canadians have accepted the internet as a commerce tool, as for payments, for other, and they don't see it as being illegal, and they don't see it as being unregulated. No matter how much you say and jump up and down and say so, the reality is over a decade now, Canadians have more often than not thought it's been regulated and taxed by the government when it hasn't. And you got to catch up to the public. They're smarter than you think. And they will move with their dollars. And if they see value in entertainment and doing something, and they're doing it. And so we have to respond. And that's what we have to keep telling people. We have to go back and have the conversations over and over again. As I said, some of the conversations we had in the early 2010s and others around VLTs and other things in provinces, well, they're similar to conversations we're having now about iGaming. And that's just, it's different delivery channels for the same products, basically. but we can do things to ensure, and as an industry, we're committed to that, ensuring that there's strong consumer protection measures and that there's a commitment to ensuring that there's healthy play and educated players on understanding how to use the product properly.
Paul, on the tax issue, I mean, this in Ontario, we've seen the provincial government taking hundreds of million dollars in tax revenue over the last 2 years. Would it not help the industry for the government to come out and actually say that we're steering a percentage or X percent amount of this tax revenue towards mental health addiction or specific gambling addiction programs?
Yeah, well, the province of Ontario is the 2% commitment towards problem gambling has been there. The nature of being able to fund and obviously the recent announcement that the RGC is receiving $9 million for the next 3 years, specifically for iGaming, for research and other programming, I think is great. But there's been always been strong funding in the system in Ontario, and for governments across the country have always dedicated dollars to this, and which is why we have a strong level of research and why we've had good programs and access to treatment. There's not been a barrier to that, and I think it's understanding, and I think governments, their commitments to it are still strong. I know whichever jurisdiction you want to talk to in Canada, they all have the commitment is there, and I think that the ability to making sure we're addressing the need, I think, is important. But also then, but I think a lot of it is built into education and awareness, so people understand when they start their relationship with gaming, what it's done in a healthy manner. But it will always be an area where we need to continue to evaluate and innovate, because things will change in time and people change, and how they interact with gaming is like, there was a time when people were like, oh, cashless and using credit or bank cards or credit cards, that was awful. Well, in fact, we're seeing that's a whole product category that's built on just that. But there's also a generational use that we have a generation that doesn't carry cash anymore. How do we get more of the cashless options into land-based casinos, which are still predominantly cash? How can we get more known play in a casino environment? I think there's lots of things we can learn from, because cash will always have a place, but I also think that we need to give customers options. I mean, so 2 years ago, we did regulatory standards for cashless play in land-based casinos. And our drive as the association for doing this was, we don't become the last novelty act in the world that uses cash. It's, to make sure that you're meeting the needs of your customers first and foremost, and that the regulatory regimes sometimes don't always keep pace with customer preference. And we wanted to make sure that happened. And there's still work to do there. But the ability to continue to evaluate and understand customer and understand preference and understand how to educate and interact, like responsible gaming programs, if the evolution over the last number of decades with from a pamphlet and this and a 1-800 number on an ad has evolved into a lot more sophisticated programming, research, and interaction with customer. You know, and we've been leaders in that. Like the GameSense program developed in British Columbia is phenomenal. And, you know, MGM took it and applied it to the resorts. And they took it one step further and they said, we're going to build it right into the part of our loyalty program. And so it's we can interact with players through our conversations with them on the loyalty program. We can educate them about responsible play tools and build it right into integrate it into our business. Well, technology allowed them to do that. And those are the kinds of things we've seen the evolution of all these things. And I think it's we're going to keep seeing. And that's because the government commitments are there. And I think that that's unwavering. But why are the government's commitments here? Because they know we profit from it. And that's clear. And that's, you know, that's the Canadian gaming model. And, you know, we can, and I'm always to say to people, yeah, we do things differently here. It's, we always have and always will. Because that's just the nature of how this evolved and what's acceptable to the public and to governments and decision makers. And that's great. Within that, we've evolved and evolution of the industry is happened and will continue to happen.
I was going to say that, is it fair to put it out there that part of the reason why we might be seeing a rise in people calling gambling problem hotlines and that is because there is a regulated market now and there is a lot more communication and people know where they can go for help?
Well, that's 100%. That's exactly what why the use of the Connects 1-800 number in Ontario was not in ads, was driven through Think TV in the industry. Because when they saw ads coming in for approval, they started seeing different numbers and they kept asking, why are we getting different numbers? And why can't we have one? And everybody went back and said, you're right. Let's use the Ontario Connects 1-800 number and made it that if you're going to put that in an ad, so for television ads, it's the 1-800 number. On digital ads, it's the connects.ca. And that appears in advertising. And that was an industry, again, that's not a regulatory requirement. That was the industry working with Think TV and the broadcasters to making sure there was some consistency. What's been the result of that? Connects went from very few brand impressions of its services, its numbers, its websites, to hundreds of millions of impressions. So yes, everybody says, well, that's a horrible thing that people call. No, it isn't. It's fantastic. Why? It shows that it works. We want people to call. If you need help, you know how to know where to go. And if we can do that, more and more people call, fantastic. Because that's exactly what it's designed to do, to be used. If you need it, call.
Hey, I do want to, we only have you for a bit longer. I do want to get into Canadian Gaming Summit before we wrap up, Paul. But the last question, just, you know, there's been a suggestion lately, seen this in the U.S. and in some places in Canada and other jurisdictions as well, about advertising going the way of the tobacco industry and basically there being a total ban on advertising. And just your, is that a concern for the Canadian Gaming Association and the people you're working with?
It is a concern. It is. I'm participating at the International Gaming Advisors Summit conference at the end of May. And I'm going to be participating in a panel with people from different parts of the world on this topic. Because it's happening, the conversation's happening everywhere. But no one can understand why. What's the intended outcome? What's the research say that the effect will be? Because we don't know. And that's dangerous. Because there's also unintended consequences of making regulatory decisions. Because it doesn't mean people won't use the product or find it. It's the fact that will they know the difference between what's a regulated site that meets a set of standards and one that doesn't and has no standards, that's there to take your money. So that's the challenge of this conversation is what's the outcome going to be? If just banning advertising is, do you think that the rates of problem gambling will change? No. Problem gambling rates have been fairly constant, regardless of the access and availability to gaming in society. The reality is that if you want to, what we want to do is make sure people have a healthy understanding of what gambling is and isn't, how to interact with the product. It's entertainment. It's there for fun and socialization. It's there to not to help pay your rent. All of those things we all talk about. But it's the understanding of in a time and a place when, you know, people listen to the radio and television, got the newspaper at their front door every day, and that was the media business per se. Lovely. But the digital world is not that, and there's lots in, you know, on the internet that is not nice and not good and destructive. And we as an industry want to create that regulated marketplace so people know that this is the way to interact with the product. This is how the product should be. This is so you can trust it, so you're not going to get ripped off. You lose a lot of that if you can't lose the ability to message. And I think that's the dangerous part. But I think it's understanding that it comes with the regulated marketplace. And that there's a lot of rules around what's content of advertising and how it's portrayed and what's in it. And that will continue to evolve as we learn more, with research tells us the effectiveness of what is occurring. I think when we saw the UK white paper, there was no additional restrictions on advertising because I think they recognized the fact that they didn't know the effect of what they'd already done. And I think that's what you need to do. It's evidence-based research. No one in this industry, in the gaming industry, will fight you on the fact that if there's evidence-based research saying you should do X or Y, we should do that. But, you know, there's a lot of, we've gone through, and not to disparage, but we've gone through a lot of time when people thought, well, if you just put warning stickers on machines, or if you have more clocks and windows in a casino, or you have, but understanding some of those things are affect some people, but not by and large a lot. And so it's what is effective to understand, is it, because, and then there was a body of evidence that said, well, having interventions with gamblers at a casino is not probably the best place to do it. It's actually, we need to get them when they're not there before they go, and educating players in different environments, as opposed to trying to do it in the environment itself while it's happening, is probably the wrong time to do it. It's an evolution again with this, as we learn in human science, will tell us in behavior what's going to be, you know, effective. But by and large, we know that education is strongly, it helps. And I think that's when we continue to be part of that. But I think that, you know, the banning of advertising but, you know, and equating it gambling to smoking is just ridiculous, in my opinion, because no one has ever said, you know, 4 cigarettes a week is fine for your health. It's not going to cause you any harm. Go right ahead. But we know that people can spend $25 a week buying lottery tickets or betting on sports and have a quite healthy relationship with gambling. And so they're not the same. And anybody who thinks they are, it's ridiculous, because it's just not, they're not the same product. And that just means we have to, you know, do better at educating people on what we are and what we're not. But banning advertising is a simplistic solution. And, you know, it's, you know, people are worried about volume. Well, the volume is, year over year out of Ontario, we've seen on broadcasts, it's down over 30%. And the work the broadcasters and leagues did to put boundaries around gambling advertising in their products, no other sector or industry has done that before. So to say that the people haven't paid attention or cared is just nonsense. And that's the thing, all of these things that have gone together, that people do care and are making efforts and are evaluating programs continually to make changes. If they need to, they know they're going to work better. And so, you know, I just think it's a moment in time we'll go through as an industry, but I think it's an overly simplistic solution. Because people think if you don't see it, it doesn't exist. Well, that's ridiculous. And that's not a healthy way to educate people and young people of understanding how to have the right relationship. Just like I do as a parent with, you know, drinking and driving and drugs and social media and all of these things. And we're caught in a phase is it's a bit of the digital addiction issue is wrapped around our industry. Because we are one product on the mobile device of millions that are there. But there's other issues with digital devices and digital addiction and social media platforms and other things that are as problematic and that we're getting caught in as an industry. And we need to put ourselves and have that debate within that context is going to be very important for us too.
Yeah, that's such a great point about just the state of digital overall and the influence it has on all of our lives. Hey, Paul, I want to wrap up by giving you a chance to wave the flag for the Canadian Gaming Summit, which takes place June 18th to 20th at the Metro Toronto Convention Center. And for the second year in a row, the Canadian Gaming Association is collaborating with SBC on the conference. And had a chance to take a quick look at the agenda before we started the interview, and I'm looking forward to being back this year and moderating a panel discussion on the collaboration between sport leagues and gaming operators. I'm definitely going to attend your player protection panel with Catherine Germain from IGO and Marie-Noëlle Savoie from BCLC on responsible gaming initiatives across Canadian provinces. It feels a little bit like an unholy alliance. There's a panel with leadership from a lot of corporations that's going to be moderated by Will Hill, the friend of Gaming News Canada, the executive director of the Canadian Lottery Coalition. And of course, there are a couple of panels on Alberta because I think any one of us in the gaming industry are kind of looking at Alberta right now. And I'm wondering how long it takes for the drop and for Alberta to become the second province to have a regulated gaming environment. But I'm sure you've been, well, I know you've been knee deep in putting together this agenda for this year's show.
Actually, I haven't been knee deep. That's one of the benefits of having a partner like SBC. In the CGA, we used to host the Canadian Gaming Summit. I was, and we were. The great team at SBC has done because they have a nice global reach and are specialists in the gaming business, which is one of the reasons why we wanted to do what we did with them and sell them the summit and begin this partnership. They've done a tremendous job in bringing this together. We're great to be back in Toronto. And we do have, it's great to see the wide depth and breadth of the gaming industry is going to be represented and be a part of the event, which is always what we strive to do. And it's we've done those leaders panels in the past, and it's nice to see it back again. And I think that it is a chance for the industry to get together to have important discussions, which we need to have. But also it's lovely to bring everybody together oversimplified, but it is a bit of a family reunion in some ways. The industry in Canada is growing and is good, strong in size, but it's still a lot of familiar, friendly faces, and it's not that big when you can get to know a lot of people. So it is great an opportunity to have the event in the way that it's constructed with a strong educational component of the plan, a great networking opportunity. So it's it's grown in the last couple of years, thanks to obviously Ontario's iGaming market, but also just the industry coming back from COVID and people picking back up again and getting out. There'll be close to 3,000, if not more than 3,000 people in Toronto this year for it. And it's always fun. And it's a chance to, as I said, to celebrate what we do, at the same time, continue to learn. And that's the important part of all of this. So I look forward to it. It's a busy week, my schedule is already filling up quite nicely. And I think I'm on way too many panels, but I just got to figure that one out. But it's nice to be able to, with the player protection symposium as part of this, talking about and spending a day talking about responsible gaming and the work we do is important. And that's a great way to lead off this event and then into all of the other and bringing other stakeholders between the sports media and sports leagues and who are new stakeholders to our industry in the last few years. And the charitable gaming industry, which is strong in this country and all of that, the great work that they do. So it does represent the depth and breadth of our sector and our industry.
We get a few, it's funny, when I go to Secaucus for the FBC Summit North America, some of our American friends, and we have a lot of Americans who listen to this podcast, so they'll tell me that, because I'm in Secaucus, I won't be going to Toronto in June for the Canadian Summit. What would you tell people south of the border, who've never been to the Canadian Gaming Summit before?
Well, I think if you ever want to do business in Canada and learn how to do business in Canada, then you need to come. Because there is some uniqueness to us, and I talked about this earlier. There's some uniqueness to the Canadian market. It's always will stay that way and be that way. And there's no better way to learn than to come and be part of it. And that's important. And that's what that's what I say to people. It's like, if you really want to do business here, and we've seen how, like, from those who have been providers of online gaming content, what brought them here may have been all of the operators entering the Ontario marketplace. A lot of them moved on to sell to lottery corporations in different provinces who are running sites too and want to sell. So there's opportunities, and that's the other part that we are to show and then come to learn into. And it's a great place to network and meet and make those business connections if you want to do business here.
You can find more information on the Canadian Gaming Summit at sbevents.com and through the canadiangaming.ca site as well. Paul Burns is president and CEO of the Canadian Gaming Association. Paul, we could probably do this for a couple of hours.
We could.
Yes. And, but we'll end it here today. And listen, I'm hoping that we can get together. I think we're going to try to take the Gaming News Canada show on the road again to the summit in June and do a live show from there. So hoping you'll drop by and we can catch up with you then.
Love to, as always, like to chat, Steve, and anytime. I'm always happy to come and share and thank you for all of what you do in spreading our messages, and which is we're grateful for. And we can also talk hockey anytime you like. So
you got that's a date, Paul. That's Paul Burns, and that's it for this episode of the Gaming News Canada show. As always, you can find this podcast at gamingnewscanada.ca. And on the various podcast platforms, we're grateful to everyone who listens to this show. And we look forward to seeing you and hearing from us again soon.
Thank you for listening to the Gaming News Canada show. Sign up for our newsletter at gamingnewscanada.ca. Follow Steve McAllister on LinkedIn. Message Steve if you're interested in being a sponsor or featured guest.